Oak session number 12137, reel 1.
Group Captain Sheen, reel 1. Can you tell me, first of all, where you come from?
I was born in Australia, in Sydney, and I was brought up in Canberra until I joined the Royal Australian Air Force as an air cadet in January 1936.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a plasterer.
And did you go to school in Sydney?
In Canberra, Canberra.
How old were you when you left school?
I was 16.
And what made you decide to go into the Air Force?
Well, it... a series of events, really, because when I was at school, we had a series of people coming through Canberra, like Bert Hinkler, Amy Johnson, Gene Batten, and they all landed in a paddock just opposite our school, and then they all went up to Parliament House where they were given a cheque or something to record their arrival. And then in 1927, the then Duke and Duchess of Kent, of course, the later on King George VI and the Queen, went out to open the new Parliament House, and the Royal Australian Air Force had a fly past there with old DH-9As, and one of those landed in a field not far from my house, and I thought, well, that's for me, and that's why I decided that as soon as I was old enough I would join the Air Force, which I did.
Was it easy to get in?
I don't know. I don't know how many applied, but I think there were about 35 of us who were group granted air cadetships at Point Cook, number one FTS Point Cook. I think six were very rapidly eliminated, but the rest of us completed our training all through 1936 to the end of the year.
Did you find it easy to learn to fly?
Yeah, but matter of fact, yes. I think I had about 6.5 hours solo. Something like that. But, you know, it was not difficult, I found.
Did it come naturally to you?
I think so, yes. I was flying Avro Cadets, which were, half was on Tiger Moths, and the other half were on Avro Cadets, which I found very pleasant to fly.
Did you have any conception at that time that a war was on the way?
No, none at all.
Would that have made any difference to you joining the...
Oh, I don't think so. No, not at all. I wanted to fly like everybody else. We were, I think, an air-minded group. That was the age of air-minded people who wanted to fly, and the opportunities were very, very limited. I mean, a lot of New Zealanders came over to the UK because they didn't have any opportunities in New Zealand. I was lucky because I was one of those that joined the RAAF, and so that was an outlet for me, or an inlet, if you like to put it that way. And that's what started it.
Is Australia a good place to learn to fly?
Oh, yes, I think the weather factor is so much better. Training purposes, it has a sticky passage like dust storms and things, but initially the weather factor is good from a training point of view, and I'm sure that helped a lot.
How did you come to be in the RAF in 1937?
At the end of our course, when we got our wings, we had the option of staying in the RAAF or taking a short service commission in the RAF. And 25 of us agreed to come to the UK. And I thought it was a good place to, you know, a good time to go and see a bit of the world and see the old country. And I was one of them. And so when we arrived in February 1937, and of course we're commissioned as pilot officers, and that was the start of our short service commission.
What were the terms of the short service commission?
6 years in the RAF plus 4 years reserve service in the RAAF.
And when you arrived in Britain, did you still not realise that the war was coming?
Well, I think it was beginning to... Be in people's minds, but not too seriously at that time. But of course, very soon things did get pretty dicey.
Did you always want to be a fighter pilot as opposed to bombers?
I think so, yes. Yes. That was my choice, and that's where I was sent anyway. So if I'd been sent to bombers, I would have gone to bombers, but I was quite happy to be given a posting as a fighter pilot.
What was the attraction of fighters specifically?
I think the aircraft, a bit more lively and energetic and manoeuvrable, you know, it's just a bit more exciting, I suppose, is the way to put it.
Did you find much difference in the RAF from the Australian force?
Not a great deal at all. I think the system was the same, the training methods were the same. I had with the others a very short operational training course, which lasted about 3 months, and then straight to a fighter squadron. But I couldn't detect any difference in the methods or the training at all. Really, it was just based on the same principles.
Was the discipline any different?
No.
All the people?
No. No.
I think you joined 72 Squadron in 37. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, we went to, at least the squadron had just moved to Church Fenton. It was the first Gladiator Squadron, and at Church Fenton in 1937, in June, we were living in tents at the end of the airfield while they built the mess. The hangars were up, the airman's mess was up, the sergeant's mess was up, but ours was about a foot high when we arrived, and we stayed in tents until the fog and the mist in November drove us out into the hangars, where we slept until the mess was completed.
And where is Church Fenton?
It's halfway between York and Leeds, in Yorkshire.
What did you think of the Gladiator?
Oh, it was a lovely little aeroplane, really beautiful. Because it had I think we were the first ones that had a sliding cockpit, which made a lot of people envious with the open cockpit fighters. But it was a beautiful aeroplane to fly and very manoeuvrable, and I liked it.
And the personnel of the squadron?
Mix. We had people from England, Canadian. There's myself, and a New Zealander. We were a very small squadron, of course, in those days. I think there were only about less than a dozen pilots at that stage. On the other squadron that was at Church Fenton, that had people, from all over the world. So we were really a Commonwealth station, if you put it that way. At least the pilots were from the Commonwealth.
How did people get on with each other?
With a lot of hilarity and a lot of fun, and extremely well.
Was there any conflict?
No, I wouldn't say conflict. There's a lot of taking the mickey out of each other, but it was all very friendly, good sport.
And the leadership of the squadron?
Exceptionally good. The first one was a squadron leader, Rogers, who later went on, was killed test flying. Another chap was Hope, Freddie Hope, who was an ex-Snyder Cup pilot. I think he was later on killed during the war. And then we were taken over by Air Marshal Sir Ronald Lees, who was another Australian who went through Point Cook some years before me. And, of course, he became a Commander-in-Chief of Germany, and he unfortunately died just 2 or 3 weeks ago. But he was a very distinguished officer and a great leader.
What was morale in the squadron like?
Oh, excellent. That sums it up, I think. Excellent.
Were there any accidents? Serious ones, I think.
Oh, yes, I think afraid that before the war, most squadrons had accidents, and we lost a couple of pilots in Gladiators with various ways, but I think we all accept that as quite normal, really, way of life.
What was the squadron doing when war was declared?
We were still training. Of course, we converted to Spitfires, fortunately, in 1938. And so we started the war with Spitfires at Church Fenton.
What do you remember about the first arrival of the Spitfire?
Oh, quite exciting, because we had no experience of aircraft which undercarriage you had to pull up and I had to pump up, really, because you had to change hands. In those days, there was no automatic undercarriage. You had to change hands and pump up with the right hand and then go back to with your throttle on the left. But we found them quite exciting. It was rather like flying a new racehorse.
Did people become attached to the Spitfire?
Loved it. Everybody loved it. I don't think of anybody who's ever had a harsh word to say about it, because it was a beautiful aeroplane to fly and it seemed to just fit round her.
How much did people in those days, just before the war started, know about the Luftwaffe and what they had?
Not a lot, except that Squadron Leader Rogers used to, at that time, he used to spend all his holidays in Germany with a pair of binoculars, and he came back saying that when the war came, which it was going to come, it would be a mass of not just fighting against one, but against very large formations of aircraft. And of course, he was right.
What do you think of the preparation which you had for war?
Unfortunately, it was for the wrong type of war. As I say, we were trained to attack large bombers, large formations of bombers, and the attacks that we were drilled into were designed for that purpose. But of course, when the war came and the Nazis moved over to, well, the Germans moved over to the coast and they started having escorts of 109s, of course, all those tactics went out of the board. They were quite useless.
Did you hear Chamberlain's broadcast?
Yes.
Whereabouts did you hear it?
Sitting in the mess at Church Fenton at 11 o'clock I think it was a Sunday morning. We were all waiting for it, and then of course when it came we realised that was it, the game was on.
What was the atmosphere in the mess like when you heard it?
Oh, I think a bit of relief, I suppose is the word, because there had been so much messing around. We'd been called back off leave the year before at the time of Munich, and when we still had gladiators, and we were sort of making up ammunition, so we knew that the war was coming, and it was just a question of when. And when it did come, of course, we said, okay, well, that's it, now we can get on with it.
What did you expect to happen straight away?
Well, I thought that we would be attacked by formations of bombers, but of course there was a fairly quiet period.
What was the first time you were actually in action yourself?
Well, on October the 21st, when a formation of Heinkel 115s were attacking a convoy off the east coast near Hull, and a friend of mine, Jimmy Elson, and I went off and we went in and attacked them with a certain amount of success. But that was, I think, the main effort by the Germans at that time was on attacking convoys. It was not a great deal over land.
Could you describe what happened on that occasion?
Well, I shot at I think I was obviously, I killed the observer, and it got very erratic, the aeroplane. I never claimed it as possible or confirmed, but I think it was confirmed later on that it went to the sea. And so another one with Jimmy Olsen got. But that was isolated. I think they used the 115s again in the convoy, because they really learnt their lesson.
What was your method of going in for the attack?
Dead astern.
How close would you get before you fired?
Oh, I think about 100 yards. But it was weaving, of course, a great deal. That was to be expected. But obviously, the observer, he stopped firing very soon, and I think he was obviously killed, and I suspect that maybe the pilot as well. I don't know.
Were you conscious of incoming fire?
Yes. To start with, yes, but not for very long.
How frightening was that?
Not a lot, not really. Not. I think one concentrates on what you're doing and you ignore the other. And then, after that, we moved up to Dremmen in Scotland. And then the next combat was again I think, a formation of seven Heikel 111s, which are doing a freelance patrol, just looking for anything they could find. And the flight was attacked those, and during which I was wounded and got a shot through the ear, and one in the backside, and another in the petrol tank. And so I managed to get back to Lucas, which is another airfield in Scotland, and I went to Edinburgh Castle Hospital, where I spent a very pleasant Christmas.
Can you describe in detail how that happened, the wounding?
Yes, I was closing on one on the right, and there were obviously some pretty clever gunners on the other two aircraft in this formation of three, and one of them was just a bit too accurate, because he picked me off.
What was the first thing you were conscious of when you were hit?
A bloody great bang in the ear and a thump in the backside.
Whereabouts was this?
It was near Bell Rock Lighthouse. In fact, we flew below the level of the top of Bell Rock Lighthouse, which is off the coast of Scotland.
Was it December 1939?
Yep. Again, I'll just... That was December the 7th, 1939. I think I was the first fighter command chap wounded in the war. I don't know, but I think so. In the UK, anyway.
Did you recover from the injuries fully?
Oh, yes. I was back within the squadron in the beginning of January, or early January, and back to normal duties.
Did your comrades come and visit you?
So the CO came. Yes, I had a couple of visits, but it was, of course, about 30 miles away. Graham was about 30 miles, and I think they had lots of other things to occupy their mind. Yes, I had a visit, but...
What was it like operating from Graham as compared with Church Phantom?
Much the same. They're both grass airfields. They both used to get very muddy, and... which were a bit difficult with Spitfires, but there we are. Standard practice. Both the same.
Can you tell me about getting back into action after your period in hospital, please?
Well, things were very quiet. As I said, we were just doing mostly convoy patrols, and I had no more action until in April 1940. The squadron was asked to provide a fully operational pilot to go to what was then known as the Photographic Development Unit at Heston. Not was known about it because it was fairly hush-hush, but the CO decided that it would be done by drawing out of the hat. He didn't like to detail any particular person, and I got the short straw, and so I joined what became 212 Photographic Reconnaissance Unit at Heston in April 1940.
How did you feel when you drew the short straw, as you put it?
Very sad at leaving the squadron, but was something new. I didn't know quite what to expect. It was just a change. Well, why not? It's flying Spitfires. Be something different, and let's have a go. So,
what did you find when you got there?
It was very interesting, really, because we were flying aircraft which had no guns, no ammunition, no radio, and just cameras, and the weight was they'd taken out was made up with fuel to give extra range, and so the operations were mainly over Germany at that time. But then I flew down with the Wing Commander Cotton, who was mainly responsible for opening up the unit, or starting it, and I went down to on a reconnaissance with him in his own private little aeroplane down to Corsica to recce a site to start up operations in the south of France. And we visited a couple of airfields in Corsica. Bastia was one of them, and Jatsia was another. And then, after we got back, I was joined the detachment that went. There were three pilots, one Spitfire, and we had a Tokamak. I don't know how that got down there. And we had a Hudson, which was a support aircraft. And we operated, starting from Corsica, at a place called Ajaccio. And then when the Italians came into the war, our job, in fact, was to photograph all the bases that we could in northern Italy. And I think we just about got most of them when the Italians came into the war. And we had some great deal of difficulty getting the French to lift up enough stakes off the airfield, which had been immobilized overnight, so that we'd all fly back to southern France, to a little place called Le Luc, which is a French Air Force base. And so we started operating again from there until the Italians came across, and we saw them attack with CR-42s, our neighbouring Royal Naval training station at Ayers, which was the training station for the Navy with the Swordfish. And then we got our share because they attacked us and blew up the Hudson. And we were in a fair amount of trouble. We had a Blenheim which had come out to pick up our photographs to take back to the UK. And one of them, they landed at a place called Salon and found out that things were in a pretty bad way. So they drove back and warned us, and I flew up in the Tiger Moth to Salon, which was an RAF base, in fact, and there were a lot of Wellingtons which were all loaded up to bomb the Italians, but they'd been forbidden by the French, who'd covered the whole airfield with vehicles to stop them taking off. And they said, well, things are getting pretty dicey, and it looks as though the French have packed up. And, of course, after we got it, when we realised that we'd lost our aircraft, our support, Dunkirk was over, and the war obviously finished, as far as the French were concerned. So we flew the Spit went back to the UK. The pilot of the Hudson went back with the Blenheim, and the rest of us went. I flew a Tiger Moth to Ayers, which is the naval air base where it was destroyed. And then we joined up with the Navy, who arranged for us to, with the party which was being evacuated, to go to first to Algiers, and then we went by train to Casablanca, and then on a refugee ship back to Gibraltar, and then eventually in a convoy back to the UK. So we left France in June the 17th and got back in the UK, I think it was 10th of July.
When you say we, how big was the unit?
Well, there were just the three pilots. One, of course, who flew back with the Spitfire. The other flight commander and myself, and an intelligence officer, and about a dozen ground crew. That was all.
Was Cotton with you all the time?
He visited us once on the way when we were in Le Luc, and he said it would be all right, but I never saw him again, because when we got back to Heston, he had gone. I don't know why, but there was some trouble, I think. He went. So I never saw him again.
What kind of impression on you did he make?
Either was a kind of a pirate, really. He was he's an extraordinary character, but I don't know whether you know him or not. But
No, I've never met him. But I've read about him.
Yes, he had quite a reputation, but he had some very good ideas, and he certainly started the PR unit with the right aircraft, because they'd been trying to do it with Benhams, I think, which of course were hopeless. And he'd had a bit of success. I think just before the war, he'd taken a lot of photographs from Germany with his Lockheed 12, which he owned. But he was an entrepreneur and a go-getter. And although he was a wing commander by rank, it was just a nominal rank. I think it just sort of gave him some substance in the Air Force, because he was a really a born out of his time, I think.
In what way was he like a pirate?
I think he was out for what he could get. You know, he had his ideas were good for the Air Force, but I think that he also pretty good for himself. He invented a thing called the flying suit we had before the war was called Sitkut, and he invented it. You know. And he invented the bubble hood for the Spitfire, and I think he took out a patent on it. You know, it's a sort of thing he would do.
So he had an eye for the main chance.
Yeah. Like he got his aircraft re-engined free by the RAF, I know. He was quite a character. And I think that when I was down in the south of France, I think he was doing some things down there with an American that were not really strictly Air Force jobs, but I can't comment on that. Certainly not for a record like this. But
coming back to the PR work, how many PR flights do you think that you must have made, approximately?
I think not a great number. I did two or three over Germany. I think about a dozen over Italy until we were knocked out, and then a couple more over Germany when we got back. And then the war was beginning to hot up, and I thought, well, obviously the action was getting a bit tough, and so I applied to go back to 72 Squadron, which was agreed, and I went back at the end of July to rejoin 72 Squadron.
Just before we go back to that, if I can say something else about the PR work. Whilst you were doing that photographic work, were you ever pursued?
Never, no. The aircraft were camouflaged pale blue underneath, and one that we flew at very high, about 32,000 feet, and at maximum speed, and making sure that you weren't leaving a contrail, which of course was fatal, but no, I was never in any trouble.
How did you make sure you weren't leaving a contrail?
By looking behind every now and again.
And if you were?
Well, you either went up or down, but to get out of the contrail height, which is usually about 30,000.
You just experimented.
Mm.
Did you like doing that kind of work?
Oh, I thought, yes, I loved it. Very good. Mm. Very, one was on one's own. We used to get very cold, but apart from that, I thought it was good fun. Really liked it.
How did you handle the cameras?
We had a little control panel on where the gun sight used to be in the Spitfire. There was a little control panel for the cameras, which one sort of pressed the buttons at the appropriate time to start them and stop them.
So it wasn't cumbersome.
Yeah. Well, they were mounted in the wings.
You just pressed a button?
That's right.
Were there any special techniques of flying that you had to adopt?